was a little bit earlier when I was talking about the Milwaukee airport and comments that former Governor Scott Walker made about how you can't find a bartender on a Sunday evening. There is an acknowledged professional about all matters surrounding the Milwaukee airport, so much so that he's named his column after it. It's called the Recombobulation Area, because that's the area where, and this is pure genius, as we await Dan Schaefer to join us. You might go, well, wait, Dan Schaefer calls his blog the Recombobulation Area? It's like, yeah, when you get through TSA, when you get through security, you feel all discombobulated. And if you know, you're always going to get a laugh the first time you see that they put up a sign just past the TSA checkpoint called the Recombobulation Area. And Dan has seized on that, used that for the name of his platform. And now, frankly, when people go through the Milwaukee airport, they will tag him in their posts. They'll use the hashtag or use Dan's handle about the Recombobulation Area. So Dan's a journalist from the Milwaukee area who has written extensively about politics. He's also written extensively about the Milwaukee Bucks. I mean, so much so that there are times I genuinely worry about him when things aren't going well. But we'll focus on the Bucks another time and just talk with Dan about last week's primary election. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Hey, Pat, doing well. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. Pleasure to finally get to be able to chat with you face to face.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll go from we'll make it a three-dimensional conversation sometime soon. But while we're talking through screens here, I was explaining, you know, the whole notion of the Recombobulation Area, because frankly, not a lot of people around Wausau, you know, fly through the Milwaukee airport. But you know, which came first, the sign or the blog?
The sign came first, and it has been always one of my favorite random things in Milwaukee, and it's been kind of like this little local icon of sorts. And I actually did some research on the Recombobulation Area when I was back at Milwaukee Magazine for our Reasons to Love Milwaukee issue. And I found out some of its pretty interesting background. The former airport director in Milwaukee just came up with the idea for it on his own. And nowhere else in the world is there a Recombobulation Area. So it's all a credit to the former airport director in Milwaukee.
When I first saw that, well, first off, I laughed hard, like I'm sure a lot of people did. But then I was pretty convinced because I thought it was so clever. I kind of figured like it would get around, like, you know, TSA agents would tell each other about it. And eventually you would see that sign, you know, all over the place, kind of tongue in cheek. But instead, I think it's been like, you know, people have said that's Milwaukee's thing. Let them have it. So that's pretty cool.
And now it's.
Title of an award-winning new site and blog that, you know, is essential reading for Wisconsin politics and also for all things Milwaukee. And Dan, if you'll forgive the brief tangent, but again, to explain to the listeners that while, you know, this is a show coming to you from Lake Wissota, from somebody proud to live in Chippewa Falls, this is somebody who has also lived in Rice Lake, who has worked and campaigned and reported throughout northern Wisconsin, but who has also lived in Milwaukee. Both my kids were born in Milwaukee, have had a couple of jobs down there, same as in Madison. So unlike a lot of the state, I'm one of these people who is just a shameless champion for both, and that frankly, both rural Wisconsin and Milwaukee need each other, need to appreciate each other better. And so we're going to talk a bit about that in one of the areas of your top 10 list. Well, not top 10, but 10 takeaways from last week's Republic or Wisconsin primary. And number one on the list, frankly, didn't get talked about enough last week. I mean, people noted it, but I mean, it really is stunning, the collapse of Rebecca Clefish in a relatively short time, somebody that had been chasing the governor's post basically since the day Scott Walker lost. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that it's number one on you know, your column here as well.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest story to emerge from Tuesday's primary is that, you know, the collapse of her campaign, that she had this 3.5 year head start ahead of Tim Michaels, had been campaigning basically since, like you said, since the moment Scott Walker lost in 2018, and, you know, had the backing of a lot of the the establishment Republicans who have been largely running the state for the better part of the last 12 years. You talk about people like Scott Walker, Robin Voss, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the Tavern League. So you had a lot of that, a lot of the people who had been in charge had endorsed her to try to, you know, continue this trajectory that Wisconsin conservatives have done over the past, you know, basically since 2010. And, you know, Michaels comes in and upends that race pretty quickly. I mean, you know, we only it was as recently as what, April, that she was just the overwhelming front runner ahead of Kevin Nicholson and Tim Ramphin. Michaels comes into the race, spends a bunch of money on TV, gets the Trump endorsement. It doesn't even seem like he had to, you know, fight a super difficult primary, and ended up winning by a fairly significant margin in a race that a lot of people, you know, even going into the results, thought might be a toss up. And I think that really, you know, it's a rejection of that Republican establishment. And I think it's a rejection of, you know, just the way that she ran her campaign too. I thought it was a very poorly run campaign as well. And I thought, you know, I wrote a preview of the race a little over a year ago, and saying that I thought she was a formidable candidate. And I thought if she would be running against Tony Evers, given the typical midterm dynamics for Republicans, she'd be the favorite. But I think she just ran an awful campaign, and voters shifted away from her as the campaign unfolded. And Michaels had a pretty decisive victory, I think. You know, I think we can get into to where he won as well.
Yeah, we absolutely will. I will note, though, and again, a lot has changed in 12 years, but there was a striking parallel to, you know, Ron Johnson coming out of nowhere in 2010, where again, the party was looking for something new. Then, you know, here comes somebody with a bunch of money, and they basically defer to him. And it seems like that same kind of deference to, you know, a wealthy, you know, self-funded candidate, you know, who would use all the right buzzwords, meant more than any establishment person who had hit all the chicken dinners, who had done all the right things with the insiders. But elections are decided by more than just the people that go to county party meetings.
Mm-hmm. And I think you saw over the course of, you know, the year that Clayfish was running as the runaway front runner, you know, there was all these stories about different potential candidates who might jump into the race. You had, you know, Trump wanting Sean Duffy to get into the race. We heard, you know, Bill McCaution, who ended up working for the Michaels campaign, Eric Hovde, Reince Priebus, Tommy Thompson, all these different names that Republicans who were not sold on Clayfish had kind of cycled through before they landed on Michaels. And, you know, it sure helps that he had, you know, a few million dollars of his own money that he could help self-fund his campaign. And then once he got the Trump endorsement, it seemed like it was all over from there.
You note number two on your list is, you know, how incredibly strong Tim Michaels' performance was across rural Wisconsin. And I mean, it makes me wonder about this. He clearly dominated in the primary. He put, you know, something like $10 million of his own money in there. But he has also, you know, committed some gaffes. He's committed some flip-flops. And I don't think the issue of him being essentially a Connecticut carpetbagger is going to go away. So I wanted to know your own, the state of that race. I mean, Michaels obviously was strong in rural Wisconsin in a primary, but how do you assess, you know, Tim Michaels and Tony Evers, you know, moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting campaign. You're already seeing kind of the pivot from the Michaels camp toward the general election race. And, you know, I think the rural urban divide is going to be played up to a large degree. Obviously, like you said, you saw Michaels do really, really well in rural Wisconsin. He won 62 counties of the 72 Wisconsin counties. And even in the, you know, kind of the Waukesha County, the Wow County area, that you know, has been the typical kind of Walker Clayfish stronghold, Michaels did, you know, really cut into the margins there. And so I think that's interesting too. And then I think as you get to the race with Evers, I think, you know, I think Evers tends to be underestimated. And I think he, you know, people underestimated him in 2018, and I think people have underestimated him throughout his time as governor. And, you know, he's a pretty popular moderate governor for a swing state, and I think that is going to help him. You know, he's been kind of a stabilizing force in Wisconsin as the Republicans have gone further and further and further to the right. And you saw, you know, Tim Michaels adopt some of those very far right positions as he got into the primary, being very far to the right on guns, being very far to the right on abortion, being very far to the right on a number of these issues, you know, election, the quote unquote election integrity, to get the Trump endorsement and things like that. I wonder if that is the type of politics that's going to win him the primary, but be a problem for him in the general election.
Exactly. And, you know, in terms of underestimating Tony Evers, I just feel like people have forgotten Jim Doyle won twice. And then several times before that for like attorney general, Jim Doyle, nobody's idea of, you know, of a fireworks show. I mean, he got the job done, you know, and people saw that. They saw he was steady, nothing flashy about him. And so, no, I'm not the least bit surprised that it's Tony Evers. I was surprised, however, that Mandela Barnes, a sitting lieutenant governor, would say, well, I know you're going to run for re-election, Governor Evers, but, you know, I see this opportunity. I'm going to go here. I had, of course, no idea how the race was going to go, but, you know, and I really did not see everybody, all the other candidates pulling out near the end. But, you know, you ended up writing something that was picked up in the New York Times last week that was, you know, the part biography of explaining why we all shouldn't be surprised about Mandela Barnes, not just, you know, his record to get here, but that this marks a real, you know, generational watershed in politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I think we can get into this after your break coming up here, but I think the Mandela Barnes candidacy is going to be the Johnson Barnes race in general is just going to be an absolutely fascinating one to watch. And I think, you know, people underestimated Evers before. I think people underestimate Barnes too. And I think part of that is the generational component. I think millennials in general tend to be underestimated in a lot of ways.
I think that we're long past, you know, the need to have senators in their 80s. And maybe it's about time we have senators who were born in the 80s.
That's right. That's right. There's only one of them right now, John Ossoff of Georgia. Mandela Barnes would be the second.
Schaefer is our races for governor, for U.S. Senate, but also for legislature and one particular congressional district that is, you know, going to be watched all across the nation. So stick around for more with Dan Schaefer. I'm Pat Kreitlow. You're up north.